You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. My guest this hour says that while overt racism is mostly gone from politics, coded racism remains. It's become a staple of partisan politics over the last several decades, and he says it ultimately hurts the middle class. What exactly are the codes, and how are we necessarily aware of them? We might not be, he says, and he wants to help us understand. We hope you'll join the conversation this hour. Where and how do you believe you see race used in political speech today? Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Ian Haney-Lopez is the John H. Bolt Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be joining you.
Well, first, let's explain the title of your book. How did you come to call it Dog Whistle Politics?
Dog Whistle Politics is a way of expressing how the public racial discourse has evolved since the civil rights movement. It now operates in two registers, like a dog whistle. On one level, it can't be heard, and on the other, it has a piercing appeal. So think of a term like welfare queen. On one level, this isn't about race at all, and that's important because it allows politicians using the term to deny that they had any racial intent whatsoever. But on the other, a term like welfare queen or food stamp president, which Newt Gingrich called President Obama, is a way of triggering racial appeals and racial fears. And so that's the origins of this term, dog whistle politics, a politics that's conducted in code in terms of a new racial discourse that on the one hand, people can say this isn't about race at all, but on the other, they're clearly using these terms in a way that seeks to strategically create racial panic.
Why are these signals used, though? And how do they? What do they achieve?
What they achieve is a way of warning people about who the supposed enemies are in their lives. And so to understand this, we have to back up just a little bit. We have to back up to understand the New Deal era. So the New Deal era, people came to understood that the biggest threat in their lives was concentrated wealth and the way it could capture government and distort the economy in its favor. And you have this expressed in ideas like the malefactors of great wealth, right? That the enemy of most of us are those institutions, those individuals of enormous wealth who think that the economy and that the society and that the political system should be run to their benefit. That begins to change after the civil rights movement when conservatives like Barry Goldwater, Richard Nixon, and I'd say Ronald Reagan more than anyone else begins to tell the great mass of the American public, look, the biggest threat in your life is not concentrated wealth. The biggest threat in your life are these scary minorities. But by this stage in American political discourse, you can't say scary minorities explicitly. You need to say it in code. And so the code becomes things like criminals, welfare cheats, lazy and irresponsible people, all of these terms that say to the broad middle class, the big threat in your life is from these scary, lazy, criminal minorities who are siphoning off resources from government. You should oppose government. You should cut taxes. And then, indeed, Ronald Reagan cuts taxes. But when he cuts taxes, it's not for the masses of Americans in the middle. It's for the richest 1%.
What were some of those code? I mean, we're talking about code language here a little bit, and I'm wondering what Ronald Reagan's codes were in your mind.
Ronald Reagan had, so he's perhaps most well known for using this phrase, a welfare queen, and he would describe a woman who was ripping off the welfare system while tooling around in a Cadillac. But there's another talk that he used to give that I think really captures this idea of a code. He used to tell the story, well, when he first told it, he told it in the South, and he'd tell a story about, he'd say to the audience, that you're waiting in line to buy hamburger while some strapping young buck is ahead of you waiting to buy a T-bone steak with food stamps. Now, this was, I think, just a bit over the line, and he was subject to a lot of criticism about it because some young buck, that's clearly a racial term. It referred to this image of a powerful, strong, young black man often one resistant to work or one lusted who lusted after white women. So it was a really ugly term. So Reagan dropped that, and across the country he would tell the story of people waiting in line to buy hamburger while some young fellow waits and is ahead of them going to buy T-bone steak with food stamps. And now we get this image of a minority, a young African-American, ripping off the system, strong, healthy, but unwilling to work, and using food stamps to actually live a better life than most people. So that's one image. But it's important to note that within this story, there's also another implicit image. It's the you in the story, the you waiting just to buy hamburger. And in the story, the you is implicitly the white, middle-class, hardworking American who's playing by the rules, but who sees things slipping away, who sees himself being taxed heavily, and who needs to figure out who's at fault. And what Reagan's saying is, hey, the person that's at fault, those are those lazy minorities, right? So these are the sort of coded terms that Reagan was using. Notice, the solution he's proposing is cut taxes. Cut taxes because your taxes are being wasted on these undeserving minorities. And so, again, we get these tax cuts, but the tax cuts that Reagan enacts alone, that Reagan alone enacts, transferred over $1 trillion in the 1980s to the top 1% of America, over $1 trillion. And so this is the core point here. This is how the middle class is wrecked. The story I'm telling is a story about race, but it's not principally about poor minorities. It's about all of us. It's about the broad middle class. And it's a story that says if you want to understand why today we have levels of wealth inequality we haven't seen in 100 years, we have a middle class in crisis, we have jobs that have gone away, we have home equity that's gone away, we have a financial system that pulled the rest of us down because it was deregulated, you need to understand the power of these racial appeals to convince voters to support politicians who are really only helping out the very richest among us.
As I think, listen to your examples, one question that comes to mind is intent versus impact. And what you're talking about here is the impact of some of these messages and the statements made by politicians. And thinking back to Gingrich, let's just play that clip to which you referred earlier.
And if I become the nominee, I'm going to take a very simple symbol. I'm going to have food stamps versus paychecks. President Obama is the most effective food stamp president in American history. No president has put more people on food stamps than Obama.
So, you know, I listen to that, and on the surface, I don't hear racial undertones, and I'm wondering if Newt Gingrich even intended for that, and whether our perception that there was an intention there is more of a reflection of our own prejudice, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a terrific question. So to me, I think that there's really, in fact, I'd say there's really two questions here. One is whether we hear it at all, and then the other is whether Gingrich intends it. So let's do this. Let's talk about the Willie Horton ad. So the Willie Horton ad, I think a lot of people will be familiar with it. But
well, we can play it. I do have that. Why don't we play that and then we can talk about it? Okay. Would you like to set up the clip first? Did you want to describe it at all? Should I just play it?
Sure. So this is in 1988, and George Bush is running for president, and he's running behind in the polls. So he decides that what he's going to do is he's going to try and tie his Democratic opponent to this criminal who was released on furlough. Massachusetts had a furlough program, who was released on furlough, but who escapes from this from his release and goes on to kidnap a couple. It's a horrific crime. He ties up the man and he twice rapes the woman. So it's a terrible crime. But what makes this sensationalistic is that it's a black man who has assaulted a white couple. And so the commercial features the mugshot of the criminal. and features his arrest. It does not, on its surface, ever reference race. And so if you play an audio clip, you won't hear a direct racial reference.
Okay.
But on the other hand, the visual impact of the commercial is striking because it shows the face of a sullen black man. It's his mugshot. It's grainy. It's frightening. And that's the sort of visual wallop. Now, if you want to play the clip, and then I'll talk a little bit about it.
Sounds good. Here we go.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
So there it was.
There you go. Now, a couple of things. Whether it's intentional, whether it was heard. Was it intentional? That use of race was completely intentional. This was the product of Lee Atwater, who had come out of the South as a political strategist and who understood completely the power of these racial provocations to stampede white voters. And several years after this ad would come out, there would be a lot of investigations of the ad campaign and its origins and participants, and smoking guns would come out where they reporters would discover campaign officials who were saying things like, Willie Horton was a wonderful combination of liberalism and a big black rapist. So there's no question that it's intentional. This is what I describe as strategic racism. This is not racism based on animus. This is not racism based on hate. There may be prejudice. There might not. The point isn't the prejudice or the animus. The point is the strategic use of racial appeals in order to stampede people for their votes, for their support, right? It's conscious, it's calculating. These politicians are carefully weighing what they're doing. So on that one level, strategic, you bet. But what about on this other level, the level in which do we hear it or not? Do we recognize it or not? The Horton campaign is a really striking example. The Willie Horton campaign today stands as shorthand for egregious uses of naked racial appeals in campaigns. People sometimes say dog whistle politics. Sometimes they say that's another Willie Horton ad. And what they mean is, wow, that's another naked racial appeal. But in fact, it took 3 years before the national media accepted the idea that the Willie Horton ad was racial at all. At the time when it was playing, late in the campaign, it was Jesse Jackson who came out and said, this is just a few weeks before the election, it was Jesse Jackson who came out and said, this is really ugly. This is clearly an appeal to racial fears and a racial narrative of a black rapist and white innocence. And when he did, he was roundly condemned and ridiculed by the national media, who said, it's all in your head, you're being divisive, you're inserting race in the conversation. And, of course, the Bush administration said the same thing. We completely deny any racial intent. It's just a fact that this was that Willie Horton was a convicted felon out on furlough who escaped and then raped this couple. This is just a fact. There's no racial intent whatsoever. That's the standard dynamic with dog whistles. To work, a dog whistle has to work on two levels. On one level, it has to be something where politicians and the people using it can deny any racial intent whatsoever. And in fact, it has to be a dynamic in which most people don't clearly perceive it as racially offensive. And yet, on another level, strategically, it is designed to elicit racial anxiety, designed to manipulate racial animosity. So we see a process in which dog whistles constantly evolve, and the terms go from things that at one point are subtle enough to work to eventually terms that no longer work, but then they're replaced by something else. Now here, Cynthia, I'm going to ask, do you happen to have the audio of Lee Atwater reflecting on the evolution of dog whistle terms?
We do not.
Would you mind if I read this quote to you?
Well, let's pick that up after the break. We're talking with Ian Haney-Lopez. He's the John H. Bolt Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We're welcoming your questions and comments as well, perhaps your observations of the media or politicians acting in this manner. You could provide some examples as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Ian Haney-Lopez, the John H. Bolt Professor of Law at University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. Ian, just before the break, you wanted to mention a little bit about Lee Atwater on the evolution of dog whistle politics. I'll let you pick up from there.
Wonderful. Okay, so this is Lee Atwater. Again, he worked with Reagan. He was his political director for his 1984 reelection campaign. He became the general manager of Bush's political campaign in 1988, directly connected with Willie Horton. This is from an interview he gave that he did not think would become public, but the audio recording is now easily available online. Lee Atwater says, and you'll pardon the harshness of the ugliness of the language. Lee Atwater says, quote, "You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts you. Backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. You're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes. And all these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and a byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that's part of it. I'm not saying that. But I am saying that if it's getting that abstract and that coded, that we are doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying we want to cut taxes and we want to cut this is much more abstract than saying even the busing thing, and a hell of a lot more abstract than nigger, nigger. So any way you look at it, race is coming on the back burner." So this is a lead Republican political strategist, and what he's saying is we need to keep constantly evolving these terms. States' rights, let's start with the 50s. Race used to be an ugly, express component of American politics at a time when you could use ugly racial epithets in public. After the Civil Rights Movement, you couldn't do that anymore. Today, if you were to use a term like the N-word in public discourse as a politician, that would be the end of your career. And that's wonderful. That's an enormous evolution. That's forward progress in race relations. That's to be applauded. But we shouldn't confuse that with the idea that racism has been removed from public discourse. It's simply evolved. One of the first evolutions was states' rights. Politicians started talking about states' rights. Sounds abstract, sounds like all you're talking about is federalism. But at the time, everybody knew that meant the right of southern states to resist racial integration. And then you had the term forced busing. Forced busing was a very powerful term in the late 1960s, 1970s. It seems like what we're talking about is the offense of putting school children on buses. But since that's been going on all century, that seems hardly it. In fact, forced busing was a way to express opposition to integration. And then Lee Atwater went on to connect it up with taxes. He might have talked about welfare queens. He might have talked about food stamps, right? All of these are terms that are operating as dog whistles. It's important to note dog whistles keep evolving. Statements that at one time can operate in code later come to be understood as racial appeals. They stop working as a dog whistle. They drop out of the political vocabulary, but something else gets picked up.
Peter on Facebook says the phrase dog whistle is a dog whistle. To liberals, it means we can't find anything racist that they said, but we really know they're racist, so we'll pretend that some innocent phrase indicates racism. To conservatives, it means liberals will always consider you to be a racist, no matter what you do or say. A few others on Facebook have suggested, too, that that being bigoted and race baiting, et cetera, is this a description of political discourse fair to voters and politicians, Ian?
So a couple of questions here. One is this, does this describe our reality? And the other is, how do conservatives react when accused of racial pandering? So does it describe our reality? I want people to pause for a moment and think about the modern Republican Party. It's an open secret that today's Republican Party draws 90% of its support from whites, and its elected officials are 98% white. And this is across the whole country, a country that is 64% white. There are not major institutions in our life that are so racially segregated. Right? I mean, this is really a remarkable level of segregation. How did that happen? It happened through an easily demonstrated process of repeated race baiting. And indeed, I don't need to say easily demonstrated. Two different chairs of the Republican National Committee have admitted to race baiting in 2005 and 2010, have admitted to decades of racial pandering. This is well known. It's sometimes called dog whistle politics. It's sometimes called the Southern strategy. Very well known. And we see the results in terms of the demography of the Republican Party itself. So I think that if you don't think it's been happening, that's just a level of denial. It's clearly been happening. Now, we can debate how central it has been. We can debate whether this is tied to wrecking the middle class or not. And that's the point that I really want to drive home. But to say, no, the Republican Party has never done that, that's just denial of a well-documented history that has been acknowledged even by two chairs of the Republican Party. All right, first. Second, what about this idea that a dog whistle is itself racial pandering? I think that's fabulous because I think that encapsulates the standard conservative response to criticisms of racial agitation, of race baiting. Here are the moves, and I'm going to describe them this way. Punch, parry, kick. Punch, parry, kick. So the punch is to constantly inject racial provocations into the conversation, for example, by talking about welfare queens or people who just don't want to work and would prefer unemployment to a paycheck. Constantly pushing race into the conversation. The parry is to stand back and to say, I didn't mention race. I just said welfare and people who are lazy, but I never said race. And since I didn't say the word black or I didn't say Latino, I can't possibly be accused of racism. And now the kick. The kick is for conservatives to turn around and say, hey, but if I didn't say a racial word, I know who did. Liberals did. It was liberals who first mentioned race. And so it must be the liberals who are the racists. It's the liberals who are introducing race into our national conversation and ruining our post-racial harmony. Punch, parry, kick. It's a standard repertoire of moves. We see it all the time. And so now when I, as a scholar, say, look, here's a book, lays out 50 years of this race baiting. Here are all these different examples. Here are these quotes. Here's all this evidence. And people turn around and say to me, you're the racist because you just mentioned race? That's totally within the standard sort of conservative discourse around race. Again, punch, parry, kick, constantly use race, then insist you're on your complete innocence because you didn't use an express racial term, and then turn around and accuse your critics of being the real racist. And here's my bottom line response to this. When someone dials 911, it doesn't mean they committed the crime. Dialing 911 is the way we call for help, the way we draw attention to an emergency. It doesn't mean we committed the crime. And it's the same way with race in America today. my saying, a lot of Democrats saying, hey, Republicans are engaging in ugly race baiting. That's a cry. That's a warning. That's to get people to focus on this emergency in American life. And for Republicans to turn around and say, well, you're the real racist, that's absurd. And we need to learn to recognize that punch, parry, kick pattern and to reject it.
You've offered several examples now of conservatives participating in dog whistle politics, but surely there must be some examples on the Democratic side.
There absolutely are. And in fact, let me start by this way. In the book, I start with the figure of George Wallace, a Democratic governor of Alabama. Really important. This is a really important point. There is no natural valence. There's no natural connection between a particular political party and racial appeals. In fact, in the 1950s, in the 1960s, the party that was most committed to racial appeals were the Southern Democrats. Right? And so George Wallace starts as a Southern Democrat. He runs in 1958 as a racial moderate. He loses to a more racially reactionary Democrat. And he promises in 1958, and again, I apologize for the harshness of the language. He says in 1958, just before giving his concession speech, no other son of a bitch is ever going to out-nigger me again. And what he means is, if I have to run on race, I'm going to run on race. And that's what he does. But he switches to this coded language and starts talking about, for example, states' rights. So you really see this transition from naked appeals to racial solidarity to more coded dog whistle terms with a Democrat. Now, having said that, we can also find modern instances of it. I think Bill Clinton is a prime example of Democrats adopting dog whistle politics. Bill Clinton's understanding of the political situation is Democrats can't run if they're too closely associated with minorities, so he makes a lot of efforts to distance himself from minorities, but also to enact policies that are understood as within the terms of dog whistle politics. So, for example, his effort to quote end welfare as we know it, where the Reagan administration had previously really done a lot to connect the idea that welfare, which helps all Americans, and where the majority of the recipients are white, but to really connect the idea that welfare is just about minorities, or Bill Clinton really drives a war on crime, where supposedly we're plagued by a sort of minority criminality. Right? So there are definitely instances of Democrats engaging in this politics. All of that said, here's the core point. Dog whistle politics is not just about using race. It's about using race as a way to convince people that they need to fear liberal government, that they need to fear a government that provides a social safety net, that they need to fear a government that engages in progressive taxation, that they need to fear a government that regulates the marketplace. And the narrative is liberal government is taking from us hardworking, implicitly white Americans and giving it to these lazy minorities. So vote for politicians who promise to slash taxes, deregulate the economy, and slash the social safety net. And that's what we've ended up with. In fact, that's what Wisconsin has ended up with. And the result has been disastrous for the broad middle class. Who's engaging most in that narrative? Conservatives. Right? And now, again, I want to be clear. There's no natural connection between a party and this sort of racial politics. But in the mid-1960s, there was a strategic choice made by conservatives to wrap their message in a racial narrative. And it's that politics, it's that strategic decision that has most closely associated dog whistle politics with conservatives over the last 50 years and that has been absolutely ruinous for the middle class.
We're talking to Ian Haney Lopez. He's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. We want to get to your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about dog whistle politics, how coded racial appeals have reinvented racism and wrecked the middle class, according to my guest, Ian Haney Lopez, professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. He's provided some examples of what he thinks are dog whistle politics, and we welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Let's take a call from Everett in Madison. Hi, Everett.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for having me on MSNBC Radio. I just had a quick question. I want to go back to when the doctor mentioned Reagan and how he was giving away tax cuts to 1%. So when I hear terms like, you know, the 1% being used frequently by Democrats, it sounds to me like a dog whistle. And also, if, like, these ideas of wanting smaller government or lower taxes are inherently racist, in what ways can we talk about them without ticking all those boxes that the doctor has researched? Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Everett. So let's take that one at a time. He's saying that he's asking, is 1% a dog whistle term as well? And how do we talk about race without talking about it?
Yeah, great question. So 1%, I would not describe it as a dog whistle. 1% is a very clear statement of incompatible interest between the very wealthiest in our society and the rest of us. And I think if you think about Democrats, you think about Occupy Wall Street. These aren't codes. This is a clear statement. This is saying to the American public, as we said during the Progressive Era, as we said during the New Deal Era, hey, we need a government. Look, government has to set the rules for the marketplace. Government has to set the rules for society. As long as it has to set the rules, we need government to set rules that favor the broad middle of our society, that help people up and that help people progress and that provide routes of upward mobility for our children. We don't need, we can't afford government that sets the rules for the very richest. There's no dog whistle. This is a clear claim about what we need. Now, we can debate it, and we should debate it, and we welcome the debate. Let's have the debate in express terms, so that we're all clear what we're talking about, right? So that's not a dog whistle is code. It purports to move in one direction, but it's really moving in the other, right? So what makes the Reagan administration a dog whistle when they say taxes is they're linking the image of taxes to the person, the young fellow ahead of you buying T-bone steaks with food stamps. They're saying that the issue of taxes is really poor minorities who are ripping off the system. Is it possible to have conversations about public policy that are not couched in racial terms? Absolutely. Absolutely. We might even go back to 1964 to Barry Goldwater. Goldwater was an ardent opponent of the New Deal. He went around telling the country, hey, the New Deal, these sorts of programs that created the middle class are actually choking us off. They reflect communism. It's an assault on individual dignity. A rugged individual doesn't need help from the government. And across the country, he was crushed. He lost big because if politicians come out and say, listen, I want to talk to you honestly about taxes. I think taxes on the very wealthiest are too high. I don't think we should be investing in infrastructure. I don't think we should be building schools. Because this is just too big a burden on the very rich who are the people that I'm really serving, they're not going to get elected, right? And so they don't have those express conversations. And so back to Barry Goldwater, he lost across the country. But he won in the five southern states, in five deep south states, in which he wrapped his hostility toward the New Deal in racial language of states' rights. And that's the moment when Republicans realized that they could take their conservative assault on the New Deal liberal government that had been good for the broad middle, and they could nevertheless win if they wrapped it in racial appeals. Right? And so is it possible to have these conversations without racism? Absolutely. And I think our society would be much, much better off if politicians were to stand up and say, listen, I'm largely beholden to large corporate interests. I'm largely beholden to my major donors. In fact, we'd be much better off if we had transparency about big money in politics. And if politicians said, so the policies that I'm suggesting, they're going to be bad for the broad middle. We're going to cut off funding for education. We're going to cut off funding for loans. We're going to cut off unemployment insurance. This is a you're-on-your-own society. And you know what? This sort of thing works really well for the people I represent because they're so rich, they don't care about unemployment insurance. They can afford the best private schools. They can afford the best private health care. Elect me. We as a society would be much better off if our political speech took those terms. But, of course, it won't take those terms because people won't elect politicians who say those things. So instead, we get politicians who imply through coded terms, I'm with you, I'm with the little guy, I'm defending you against the real threat in your lives. Those are minorities. And I should say it's usually minorities, but it could be those are people who want to take away your guns. Those are people who are a threat to your religion. Right? There are lots of sort of social, cultural provocations that are being used to convince people that the real threat in their lives are other folks in the working in the middle class rather than the very rich.
So, I mean, you just provided this example and said, you know, no politician is going to go out there and say, this is how I work and this is who I'm beholden to. Meanwhile, voters might wish to open up this dialogue and have an honest conversation about race or how policies affect those of low income and all these populations that you discuss. How do we foster a healthy dialogue about it then? What is the opening line?
The opening line? So that would be wonderful. It would be wonderful if we as a country came together and said, racial inequality is a problem that hurts all of us. And in fact, this is one of the key insights of Martin Luther King, that racial justice and economic justice have to be tied together, that we won't have economic justice to the extent that we're divided by race, that racial justice is going to require jobs, right? That would be wonderful if we as a country would say, listen, race remains a big problem in our country, and we need to all put our shoulders together and get to work solving this problem. That's not the and I think that would be very easy to have. In fact, I would welcome politicians saying, let's all put our shoulders together and solve this. That's not the conversation we have. Instead, we have a very different conversation. It goes something like this. There are no real racial structural problems in our country. There are problems with defective cultures. People are lazy. They don't want to work. They have children out of wedlock. So there's no problem with a legacy of racism, a legacy of racial inequality, dramatic inequalities in health care rates or dramatic inequalities in incarceration rates that are somehow structural. No, it's just that there are some people who have inferior defective cultures. And now when you hear the story about what those inferior defective cultures are, they turn out to be the old stereotypes that were applied to blacks and Latinos and Asians. Okay, that's one conversation. And the other conversation is we've completely beyond race. We achieved what we needed to do in the civil rights movement, and if anybody is a racial victim today, it's whites. Whites are a racial victim because they're victimized by affirmative action. Whites are racial victims because government is against them and always pandering to minorities. Whites are racial victims because people are always talking about white racism. That's the public conversation we're having about race, and I'm saying it's destructive, and it's not just destructive, and here's the point, it's not just destructive to poor minorities, though it's certainly that, it's destructive to the broad middle class because, again, it's hammering away at this idea that it's the white middle class that's the true victim and it's being victimized by minorities and by liberal government. And because of that narrative, people are voting for politicians who are destroying the government policies that are necessary to keep government on the side of the broad middle class and instead are enacting policies that favor the very rich.
Sheree emails, the consequence of using dog whistle politics impact my daily life. I am a black woman living in a city that is not very diverse. Consequently, I have to put up with surprising looks from fellow patrons when I buy groceries, go to work, drop my daughter off to her private school. Everyone there thinks that my daughter is on a scholarship while we pay full price like everyone else, and other slights. These words are damaging, and the politicians who use these words have no clue how their pursuit of power impacts my daily life. So what's your response to that, Ian? How are some of these policies or how is the dialogue in general going on to impact the daily life of some people?
I think that's an incredibly powerful quote, because what it's saying is words from politicians don't just float around in the air and then dissipate and do no harm. Words are translated into policies, they're translated into cultural beliefs, and they can have tremendous, they can do tremendous damage. So I want to think, for example, about mass incarceration. And there's a book I'd urge your readers or your listeners to read, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. The United States in 1970 had about 200,000 prisoners. Now we have well over 2 million. This vastly outstrips the population growth in the United States. The United States has 5% of the world's population, 25% of the prisoners. We incarcerate people at 500% the highest rate in Europe. Why? Because in the early 1970s, politicians started using crime as a dog whistle. They started warning people the biggest threat in their lives was crime, implicitly from minorities. And then they backed it up with policies that built the biggest carceral system the world's ever seen. Think about the damage this has done to our society. Think about the damage this does in people's everyday lives. Right, we have a system now where we shepherd hundreds of thousands of people into a punitive prison system in a way that reflects the power of dog whistle politics. So I want to be very clear about this. The impact of dog whistle politics has been horrendous for minority communities. And it's not just the impact of incarceration, it's the impact of the cultural beliefs that because politicians keep warning society, hey, minorities are threatening, they're criminals, they're lazy, or with respect to Latinos now, they're basically lawbreakers, they all snuck across the border, they're dishonest, they bring diseases with them, they're ruining our culture. Some of the most prominent public spokespersons in our country, politicians, are saying these things over and over again. It poisons our culture. It keeps us from seeing that we're all human. Mm-hmm. We're all human. And none of us is any more saintly, and none of us is any more devilish. We're all human. So I think that this has a tremendous destructive impact on minorities.
Let's take a call from Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello, and thank you for the program, Ms. Schuster and Professor Haney Lopez. I've enjoyed listening to your ideas. I'm in education, and when I go from school to school, the conversation used to be culturally deprived children, and then it was disadvantaged children. But there's always some term that takes the onus off of the teacher, off of the school system, and places it squarely on the child or their family or some. Instead of the child being seen as unique and coming with strengths and capacities that may differ from those of the teacher, they're seen as defective white kids, but everybody knows what kids are being referred to. And I think that also in the on the national scene, when Speaker Boehner is complaining that his hands are tied by the Tea Party and, you know, the far right has, you know, taken over the party, well, I think the Tea Party is just saying the things that most of the Republicans believe but have find it uncomfortable or difficult to defend. And so they stand around pretending that it isn't them. And I think the entire Tea Party with its, you know, burn government down and really the proportionate disadvantage to people who are in need of services or who have been underserved in the past is right there, and yet they don't have to take responsibility for it because they're pointing to a faction of their party that keeps pushing the dialogue further to the right without having to them have to own the fact that those policies are really harming people across the board.
Thanks for that call, Carl. And meanwhile, we got an email from Bill who asks, how should a person of goodwill advocate for smaller government and lower taxes without seeming racist? To you, Ian, or to anybody who perceives racism through this dialogue?
I think then it becomes incumbent on that person advocating smaller government to explain why smaller government is going to be helpful to a broad range of people and to really defend it with evidence. And to say, for example, trickle-down economics. that seemed to be a really strong argument for cutting taxes, and that the argument was cutting taxes is actually going to be good because it's going to stimulate the economy. All of the evidence shows that's simply not true. It's simply false. So if you want to argue for these policies, fantastic. Argue for them on the basis of evidence. Argue for them on the basis of who's really going to be helped and who's really going to be much worse off because they're not going to be, because the rules of government, the rules of the marketplace are going to end up hurting them. Have that conversation. I welcome it. Don't have the argument for small government in terms of cultural provocations, in terms of saying government's really your enemy because it helps that group and that group and that group, and we don't like them. They're scary. They're frightening. They're threatening to us. Right? Have the government, have the argument for small government on its own terms, in terms of who it really helps and who it really hurts.
Let's talk next to Cliff in Appleton. Hi, Cliff.
Hi. The professor's comments have a great ring of truth to me, and I think that a lot of people who can't appreciate what he's saying are tone-deaf in a way. When I thought about the ex-Virginia governor who was indicted yesterday on taking hundreds of thousands of dollars of gifts in exchange for helping a donor, he's going to fight it. But if a minority youth takes a Twinkie from a convenience store, he's going to be locked up. I think back to a few years ago when Reed Ribble was running for election in Wisconsin. A group of his staffers came down my street wearing like bright yellow shirts on Goldenrod Drive in Appleton. I was washing my car. I looked forward to engaging them. They stopped and talked to all of my neighbors, but never once did one of them look directly at me, and they walked by, and I was incredulous. I'm African-American, and to those of us who are impacted by a lot of this negativity, this racism in America, we get it. Our hearing is acute, and so many of my fellow citizens are tone deaf.
Thanks for calling, Cliff. What's your response to that, Ian?
I think what Cliff is saying is absolutely right. I think that a lot of people of color do hear this politics very clearly, and I think this is a very important point. Often when I say, listen, look at the modern Republican Party, 90% of its support comes from whites, often what I hear in response is, true, but if you really want to see race operating in American politics, look at black support for Obama, right? And so the argument seems to be, we're a racially divided society, so there's no big deal. No, this is fundamentally wrong, and it's wrong on two levels. One, black support for the Democratic Party is not driven out of racial loyalty. So I said dog whistle politics really starts in 1964. In 1960, 29% of African Americans identified as Republican.
Ian, I'm going to give you a 30-second warning. Just real quick, we only have just a few moments left. So just to wrap, go ahead.
So in 1964, the percentage of African Americans identifying as Republican drops to zero. Right? Blacks left the Republican Party when the Republican Party started using race baiting. That's the first error. Here's the second and more fundamental error. It is not okay for society to be divided by race. That is fundamentally wrong. It's wrong morally, and it's also disastrous politically because it's being used to harm the middle class, and that's the fundamental point.
Thank you so much, Ian, for talking with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Ian Haney-Lopez is the John H. Bolt Professor of Law at University of California, Berkeley, and author of Dog Whistle Politics, How Coded Racial Appeals Have Reinvented Racism and Wrecked the Middle Class. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this hour, Marika Suval for on-air production. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.